Blog Talk Radio.
We're on the live. We're on the air live.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, wait a minute. We got the music. We're going to go to the theme song first. Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards. We have a guest, a co-host this evening, and for the next maybe two Wednesdays, the caller known as M, the mysterious Mr. M, is taking over for Mr. Allen, who is on special assignment, if you will. But our phone lines will be open, as we're going to talk about a number of subject matters. Of course, on the lips and minds of everyone, of course, is the terror in Orlando, where at least as of this hour, this program, 50 individuals died, 49 were innocent victims, and then, of course, the 50th was the killer, a man by the name of Omar Martin, an Afghan nationality, but born and raised here in the United States of America. Father came here 36 years ago from Afghanistan. It's a story within itself. A lot of discussion going on about guns and et cetera. And so M and I will be talking about the Second Amendment and, you know, how it really works in a country that was built on the quote-unquote musket and little round ball, later become the rifle and the long projectile and et cetera. My take is, and I say it in my column to be published next week in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, that you're not going to be able to take away people's guns. There are over 300,000 guns in the United States of America. We are the best armed citizen nation in the world, you know. But, M, welcome. And we'll be opening up the phone lines and seeing what it is we will get. But a couple of announcements. First of all, we again want to send our prayers out to the ministers who a week ago last Thursday were actually caught in a crossfire of bullets and et cetera in a meeting at a facility on 37th and Emerson in North Minneapolis. Luckily, no one was injured, if you will. Gunmen firing multiple shots. The Reverend Richard Coleman, if you will, was facilitating the meeting along with Reverend Dr. Alfred Babington Johnson when these gunmen opened fire. Now, some are saying, by the way, M, that this was just an happenstance, accident, et cetera. Do not believe that. I had a chance to, of course, be called to the scene immediately, and of course that was not the take of the investigators. So,
well,
but again, our prayers are to the ministers, some of who were present earlier this evening at a prayer vigil, praying for the safety of community, both north, south, St. Paul, every place else. We'll go into a little bit more detail on that. And then prior to that, there was a very interesting meeting at the Minneapolis Park and Recreations board meeting. President of the NAACP, Nakibi Alabe-Founds, and about 30 supporters confronted in what was a very tense meeting, the all-white park and recreation board, about a multiplicity of things. They had quite a shopping list, including contract compliance, including our not keeping facilities open that are strategically and centrally located in African-American communities and et cetera. Of course, the all-white Park and Recreation Board, most of their members seemed to be disinterested, if you will. It was really hard for them to indicate that they were being attentive, if you will, really paying any attention. I mean, I don't, you know, think that they really cared much. But we had a combination there this afternoon at 5 o'clock of blacks, Latino Hispanics, Somalis. were there, and of course, white speakers. So it was very, very interesting. And again, phone lines will be open if there's any questions, acquire or facilitate any kind of questions or et cetera. Again, our number 347-426-3904. Any questions from your end, Jim?
Well, yes. You know, Mr. Edwards, on that shooting, I mean, that sounds like a very serious event, and I don't know if that information was suppressed in any way or what have you, but that, for some reason, never reached my ears until I heard it from you.
It was suppressed, and actually, I have raised the question in my own role as a journalist to the Star Tribune why this was not reported. It's just like the situation a week prior when four African-American women were gunned down at 8th and Humboldt in North Minneapolis. Four young women shot, and lost her fetus, if you will. She was about 2 months pregnant. The papers never indicated that the four female victims were African-Americans, if you will, shot by African-American gunmen. And I was saddened by that, and I've been asking the Star Tribune the question on why was it not important to indicate the race? They do it any other time, if you will. In fact, let me just give our listening audience an observation. There was a situation that is reported in this morning's edition of the Trib about an incident and relationship between a Ramsey County probation officer and an individual who was waiting to be sentenced to federal imprisonment, and the individual was being kept at a low security risk facility, and she and the prisoner had some sexual liaisons, if you will. And how they played it to let you know about the race, and it's in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. They pointed out that the young man was now hospitalized because he has sickle cell. And rather than just say that he was African American, they talked in terms of his illness and sickle cell. And we basically know, 99% of people in this country are African Americans. There may be a 2 or 3% who are Southern Mediterranean, in other words, primarily Italians and maybe Spanish. But to your Pacific question, yes, the attack was well documented by the authorities. They're still investigating. There is some video of a car that was very well involved in the shooting, if you will. Now folks are saying that it really wasn't intentional. I have to tell you that the double-plated glass, it's bad enough when you shoot a bullet hole through it. But when you see glass shattered into hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces, those are some pretty powerful ammunition. And so I don't know how the cover story is supposed to work, but yes, the community, the general public was denied information on that. Mm. And that happened last Thursday. It happened about 1:45 p.m. In fact, it was an ecumenical meeting, actually, it's ironic, to deal with the event that just concluded, and talking in terms of the level of violence and et cetera and what can be done. And there were many white ministers of the ecumenical community and all affiliated with the Minneapolis Council of Churches. You know, M, that's a very powerful ecumenical group.
Right, for sure.
And they were meeting there at this nonprofit facility, which is right across the street from Pillsbury United's Northside headquarters. So it does absolute clarity. We don't want anybody saying that on the Ron and Don program with a guest commentator, the man known as M, that we were just making something up. That's how much violence there is out here right now.
Well, I would assume then that that incident is being currently investigated. I mean, so that they're turning over every stone to find the perpetrators or the shooters of this incident. I mean,
yes, and
I
no,
haven't seen any public service to call in. If you hear anything, I haven't seen any. So I don't know how wide the net is.
Because nothing was ever put in the paper and nothing was ever on television. Even though, I got to tell you this, there were actually video put on social media, and you know, such you and Mr. Allen, as example, are a clear illustration of people who know how to call that kind of information up. There was a specific person there who had photographed the chief and a civilian, yours truly, standing, talking with witnesses and et cetera, as the shattered glass and et cetera was being cleaned up, and in fact, CSI crime scene investigators were on their way back because of a couple of spent shells that were found that hit the wall and et cetera. You know, I mean, the ministers were very, very lucky in this situation. And like I said, I was
certainly were
disappointed that our community, the entire community, was not made aware that these ministers had been fired on by gunmen. Video is being looked at. There were at least three cameras in that particular location right there, 37th and Emerson Avenue North. And they were taking a look at an automobile. I think they're trying to amplify the license number on the car. You know what I'm saying? But, again, the media never reported it.
Boy, that's... I don't know if that's – I want to say that's surprising, but then on the other hand, I guess, maybe it's par for the course. I mean, in the environment, we're undergoing now. But I do have a question, Mr. Edwards, on, something you just said a few minutes earlier about the corrections supervisor accused of having intimate relations with the individual that was in the treatment facility.
In Ramsey County, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right, Ramsey County. And I happened to run across that article, and it looks like that the individual lady was charged with third-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Yes, sir. That's
and
right.
And I guess in asking you this question, I mean, why? What made that criminal?
Well, makes it criminal was the personal relationship, sexual in nature, that a public servant was having with an individual who actually was in the custody and control of the federal government for the purpose of sentencing. And the law is very specific about relationships as it pertains
person
to
authority,
a prisoner and a
over.
Correction officer. And so she violated the tenets of some of those specific laws. And also, I guess, where they had the sexual acts. In fact, one of them, as you see in the article, was at Regency Hospital, wasn't it? And that is a violation of the operational code. And so I think that's the reason that it was third degree. That is, by the way, that is the second situation that we've had in Ramsey County in the last 3 months. There was a young white female correction officer who was involved with a young man who was incarcerated in Totem Town. And it was involved in a sexual relationship and helped that individual about, I think it was about 7 months ago that it actually happened, helped him escape. And Ramsey County had said that they were making an adjustment to their protocols and et cetera, but I guess it didn't catch on. Now, this corrections officer, I guess, had been liaisoning, we'll put it like that, with this, I clearly had to be a brother, sickle cell piece, since early April, I guess.
Yeah, it says between January until mid-April.
Yes, yes.
So
I
time.
Guess that's kind of embarrassing, but, we'll get the standard. We're working on a policy change, but they want you to forget that like I said, just about four or five months ago, a very similar situation happened in regards to Totem Town. Same kind of situation, and in that case, the corrections officer, female, attempted and did help the individual escape. He was recaptured, And ultimately, in the course of the investigative examination, I guess he just, you know, he told it, you know. So she was charged in a similar manner. Now, it's interesting because one involved a state prisoner and the other one involved a federal prisoner. The article you have there in front of you, that individual was in federal custody. These things are happening in our beloved enclaves, if you will. But yeah. I concur with you. I think that the firing on members of the ecumenical community is, I would have thought that it was something newsworthy, but I guess it wasn't.
Yeah, sounds like very, you know, I mean, with all the talk of terrorists and terror and things, you would think that, you know, a shooting of, you know, unarmed individual having a peaceful meeting in a church environment would really be cause for for alarm. You know,
I would absolutely think so. And this had been, it was clear that the perpetrators clearly knew that they would be at that facility. Actually, it's a nonprofit organization, as I said, just across the street there on 37th and Emerson from the Northside headquarters of Pillsbury United.
No, I wonder, was this a scheduled meeting? You know,
that's what I'm coming to. Yes, it is. It's their monthly meeting.
Okay.
They've been meeting for a couple of years, actually. And initially, they were out at for about a year. They were meeting on a frequent basis at is it Friendship, the church of the Reverend Billy Russell? They're on 38th and 27th, South Minneapolis.
27th Avenue, South Minneapolis.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so they had, and you know, as a part of the unity, continuity, and et cetera, they had been meeting at this facility on 37th and Emerson. And, in fact, in the statement that was given by an administrative aide to one of the key ministers indicated that these meetings were posted. And, in fact, they had met. They had just received information from one of their clergy about the violence in the street and what needed to happen and preparation to put monitors and et cetera out on the street and that kind of thing. I don't know if it was an effort to intimidate, bully, terrorize the ministers who were gathered, both black and white ministers. I just don't know. But it certainly happened. But if it wasn't, God, for this program, it would be something we wouldn't be discussing.
Boy, that's I tell you, the suppressing of information. And then again, you know, the meeting that you talked about at the park board, you know, and I do want to address a question on that because one thing you said was that the board consisted of an all-white board, park board.
Yes. There's not been an African-American on there since Merle Anderson.
Mary Merrill.
Also Annie Young, I do believe, retired a couple years ago. Both of them left about the same time. And actually, they've been the only two African-Americans ever to serve on the park board. And that question has been raised by the president of the NAACP in a highly publicized meeting in which the white chairwoman of the park board actually...
There was an outburst, wasn't there?
Yes, she was very disrespectful of the NAACP president and other people of color. Let me just say this, and this is interesting because, again, this would be an exclusive. Because we were there as a journalist, we had a chance to take a look at the agenda. And one of the things that they did is an outgrowth of even internal strife amongst themselves. In other words, the park board, they amended, and I have said document here in the studio, they amended their rules and regulations effective June 1. As it pertains to who can speak, how long you can speak, what you can talk about, what you can't talk about, when you can talk about it, and et cetera. And so I give formal notification that said document was right there when little Edwards came in, and I looked at the first thing that caught my eye. In fact, let me take the time now, and I'll make sure that we shoot a copy over there to you. Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board summary of important board meeting rules. By section, as last amended, June 1, 2016. And if anyone has any questions other than ourselves, we, you know, the people, anybody wants to call in, ask the question, we will indicate to you. In fact, I'll tell you one that's here, because we can call up on our computers. It talks in terms of even the role of the board members to speak to a proposition, because you remember there was a outburst from one of the few white board members who became very much disturbed and questioned the disrespect shown by the chairwoman of the board.
NAACP, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, they just really disrespected the NAACP. So what happened under Section 1D, 1 and 2, board members may speak to an issue for up to 3 minutes at a board and committee meetings. Now, that is something I got to tell you. If I was a board member and I'm an elected public official, you will not tell me how long it is I have to speak to a specific proposition, particularly when it was one dealing with the issue of race, diversity, and et cetera. But here it is right here. In the document, which was handed out to be distributed, and it appears to me that based on the date of the amendment was June 1, 2016, they had voted on it in committee. And it talks in terms of even how this was interesting. Key rules under Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised. In order to make take a recess, they're even telling themselves how they're supposed to say that. This is the dumbest stuff I've ever heard. I move we recess until.
Well, what prompted this? You know, that would be my question.
It was prompted by the single white male board member who questioned the conduct of his own chairperson. And what he did, I think it was the commissioner from District 6, Brad Braun. And what he did, he was asking to be recognized. You know, they have a beautiful facility over there now, and a beautiful boardroom and everything. So they're just like the big city council and the state legislature. So they have all that electronic equipment that, you know, you the taxpayers have paid for. And so what you do, you know, you press the button, you know. Even us colored people know how that works. And you press the button and, you know, the chair, they do it quite a bit at school board meetings, for example. And the chair sees that Representative M., wishes to be heard, okay, and then I recognize you. Well, what happened as the chair was just, you know, from District 1, who is the president of the board, was just berating the president of the NAACP and other citizens of color that were there. Mr. Braun was apparently asking to be recognized to, you know, raise questions of admonishment towards the chair for the disrespect of the public. Well, she wouldn't recognize him, and she apparently signaled to the engineer not to turn his mic on. So what he did is a heck of a thing. It's all in this story by, what's this guy's name, Steve Brandt, who writes very slanted kind of articles against the interest in the franchise of African Americans. Steve Brandt reported that Brad Braun got up and walked out into the audience and took the microphone reserved for the public and challenged the chair with regards to her conduct. And what she attempted to do initially was to restrict the time that he had to ask the question. Well, at that time, there was no rule with regard to any member of the board, how long you had to talk and et cetera. And, of course, what's basically been happening is that you have 9 members of the board, and I understand in the committee meetings that it was basically 7-2 with only John Olson, commissioner of District 2, who actually has a business in the midst of a heavy concentration of African-Americans, a Dairy Queen, was the only one to stand with Mr. Braun when the amendment took place. And so hopefully that's helpful to our audience. What happened in order to continue the promotion of racism by this all-white board?
And didn't the chairwoman somehow apologize or something for her behavior?
She was politically forced.
Yeah,
she didn't do it that night. She didn't do it that night. She,
oh.
Because of the possibility of a rebellion inside the board, particularly after Mr. Braun had raised these questions, and because of political pressure from the Democratic machine, she issued a policy in which, as I understand it, and maybe we have, you know, a caller that can call in and confirm what we are saying here on this program, the president of the NAACP really declined to accept the apology, indicating it wasn't sincere. Now, this evening at 5, by approximately 5:20, the president of the NAACP really laid some wood on them, and she now raised the kind of questions that you need to raise to them. And she pointed out, again, this is an exclusive for our whole team, she pointed out that there is no real policy on diversity and any contract compliance. And she raised the question for the board to be transparent with regards to the kind of contracts that they are giving to white folks and they are not giving to African Americans. And then there was a very heated exchange by a board member of the NAACP. In fact, she's a Southside resident, by the way, who raised some serious questions about sexual misconduct and bullying inside of the park board that has led to some African Americans being demoted, if you will. In fact, we have a situation over there. Richard Green? The Richard Green facility there, park board facility, where a woman by the name of Miss Wilson has been demoted twice. At one time, she was like an associate superintendent. She is now like just nothing more than the recreational building director.
Now, Richard Green, is that the school or is that a park?
The school, but they also have a adjunct or a piece of that is the Richard Green Park Facilities building.
Oh, on the same site. So that area is designated as a park.
Richard Green.
Yeah, park board.
Okay. And Miss Wilson, people weren't supposed to talk about this. We had consultation in preparation for a couple programs, and we found out from reliable sources. This is how I found out about the white manager / pro at Theodore Wirth Golf Course, who is being let go because he's been hiring too many blacks at Theodore Wirth. Now, we don't hire blacks at any of the other park board facilities, particularly in the golfing and maintenance facility, if you will. But at Theodore Wirth, at both the Par 18 and the Par 3, is a large contingent. In fact, the Par 3 is managed by an African-American. There are first time really in history young African American females are working at the front desk there at the at the Power 18 there in North Minneapolis. Well, the man who is the manager up there, and we wrote about it in our column 2 weeks ago in the Spokesman Recorder, and we have not been challenged. He's been there for 25 years. He's been a park employee for 25 years. When he was first hired 25 years ago, he did not have a degree. In fact, one wasn't necessary. Oops. What happened was in the last year, a friend of a friend was appointed the director of golf operations, in which all of the managers / pros would be reporting to. And this guy decided he had a friend, if you know what I mean, that he wanted to make a manager of one of our golf courses. Now, one of the golf courses, Meadowbrook, has been closed down and will be closed down probably for another year. Hiawatha, which I know you're very familiar with, is only partially operating, if you will.
Underwater.
And then,
flooding there or something? I don't
know. Terrible flooding, terrible flooding. In fact, the Army Corps of Engineers has done a real poor job on that. At one point 2 years ago, Meadowbrook was totally underwater, and half of Hiawatha was. Well, anyways, that means a lot of business for growth, for Columbia, for Fort Snelling, if you will. and for Theodore Wirth and Theodore Wirth's Bar 3.
Sure.
And
sure.
This gentleman has been hiring African Americans left and right, giving them every opportunity to grow and to develop and et cetera. And this current board, if you will, all white board and the white superintendent, Miss Miller and them, decided that there's just too many darkies working in just one place in the park system.
Boy, that's what a shame.
I think you and I can remember back many years ago when it was unheard of to even think in terms of a Negro being behind the counter.
I can. You know, at the same time, you know, denying jobs and opportunities, and then and then crying about, you know, the disparities and what are they doing about it? It seems like they're just pouring fuel on it. But you know, by those type of acts, you know.
Let me tell you how bad that is. There were negotiations that had been going on for about a month in anticipation of this stimulus money for diversity that was coming in.
Organization
headed by Caucasian was supposed to be negotiating at some specific point in the last 15 days or so about 40 young African Americans who could make a difference on what the temperament of this city is going to be, had agreed to bring about a truce with regards to the violence, and also that they wanted employment for themselves and some of their associates, and so there were supposed to be 40 slots set aside. Lo and behold, a couple of days ago, according to sources in Minneapolis City Hall, who are very unhappy with this, the African-Americans were told that there was only 8 positions available for them. And this from an organization that is sitting on $4.5 million in diversity and employment and youth, quote-unquote, prevention, crime prevention. So you, Em, you're right on point. A lot of funny and peculiar things happening in our beloved city.
Well, it is. It almost, you know, I hate to say disparities by design, but, boy, it's pretty hard to refute that statement when you see the things that are going on. And I would like to ask you, you know, some of our conversation, we talked a little bit about the NAACP and the president. And I guess I'd like to get your impressions of, you know, the current leadership of the NAACP. I know it's been very controversial. I know that, you know, being upfront with the Black Lives Matter movement and other issues in the Twin Cities, things that I think really need to have been brought up. But is there any way you care to give any type of a critique?
Oh, yes.
You know, on
and,
the current
it's,
regime
it's one
of
the reasons
NAACP.
That I personally went to the park board meeting. It's also one of the reasons that I wrote in my newspaper column with the Spokesman Recorder 2 weeks ago what was happening with black employment at the park system is that irrespective of what criticism I and may direct towards the NAACP president over the last year or so, and the fact that we don't necessarily have any kind of relationship, but I come from the old school, and that you always take the high ground, and you remember the importance of the mission to the well-being of the African-American race. And you have to respect, and this comes from a person who 30 years ago, with a at that time very very good friend, and quite a person, quite a human being, the late Danny Davis.
We
filed a civil rights complaint 30 years ago with the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department against the Park Board, and I put that in my column last week to challenge any of the naysayers or anyone that wanted to question the authenticity. But I have a certain spiritual feeling with regards to when I see folks stand up against institutions that I clearly know that history shows that they have been extremely biased, prejudiced, racist, and et cetera. So I have to give the NAACP president her propers, is that it really appeared today that they had really gotten their act together in regards to knowing some issues to drop on the park board, the all-white park board commissioners, that has legal implications because, see, the park board gets a lot of taxpayers' dollars, through the legislature, and they also, they have taxing rights, you know what I mean? They do have the right to tax. And you as a homeowner on the south side, as an example, and others, you know, have a right to expect that their money is being properly handled, and
right.
that the presence of
that's
African Americans
right.
is recognized and respected. And so, to your question, I hope that on this this particular program in which you sitting in for our colleague Mr. Allen, that I think it's an excellent question, and I love answering it. And so I've got to be fair, and I've got to indicate that the president of the NAACP is on the right track.
Well, you know, and in my impression, I guess I would co-sign that for the most part, because I believe that she's served a great purpose in getting their attention.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
I think
you could see that. You could see that this afternoon, early this afternoon. As I said, she had about 30 supporters. They had big placards and et cetera. Now, the reporter who covers that, as I said, is a man of questionable reputation and integrity, Steve Brandt. Now, he was running around with his pencil out and his little, what you call it, it'll be interesting to see, about now, what his preliminary story will say. And in the final print, I know just how the Star Tribune operates. At approximately 11:05, they will print the final piece of whatever story. I would be most interested and would challenge our listening audience to, you know, those that are computer savvy, if you will, to go to the website of the Star Tribune, take a look at how Steve Brandt dealt with a very effective challenge to the Park Board by the NAACP and Black Lives Matter at approximately 5 o'clock to about 5:30. In fact, the board became so displeased with the chanting and et cetera. And by the way, one of the NAACP board members, Ms. Jones, asked for the resignation of the board chair, and another member of the park board who spoke very disparagingly and very insulting. In fact, he's probably lucky, because if they ever get the wrong group of black folk in there, somebody's going to bust somebody in the mouth, okay? And this particular board member was extremely disrespectful to the African Americans that were gathered there. And so I was just glad to... In fact, I think it may have been the man who was identified as, I want to make sure, maybe the commissioner, vice chair, vice president from District 3, but maybe there's someone who has a better recollection of that. Today up there, the NAACP Black Lives Matter came prepared and laid some specifics on them. Ms. Jones, representing both community and her position as a member of the NAACP, really challenged them. In fact, the chair attempted to shut her off, but I think they had made a political decision, even though they had police on standby. Oops, as you know, the park board has its own
yes, they have
political
their own police force.
Military wing.
They have their own police force.
Yes, and the chief of the department was sitting right there to make sure that it was handled properly. But I think that the park board leadership made a decision that it really wasn't worth it. You know what I'm saying? But again, we won't know. Well, we do, because we're reporting it exclusively. But the general public, if not for us, would not know what happened up there today if Steve Brandt writes the kind of story that I'm expecting him to write.
You know, it's interesting too. You know, at one time as I was coming up, the Park Board Police was a separate entity.
Yes,
they were actually a separate entity. But over the years, now they seem to be merged along with the University of Minnesota Police Force. It seems to be almost a metro police force. Am I wrong with that? I mean, that's a perception I have. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes. Well, let me just highlight that though. By law, by charter, the University of Minnesota is a land grant college, and so they have automatic statutory authority. So their police department is their police department. The Park Board has statutory authority by charter. And their police department is actually responsible only to the park commissioners, but they can only operate in those physically designated areas that are the property of the park board. Now, they could be called by the Minneapolis Police Department to assist them, as they could call the Minneapolis Police Department that I've seen over the years when things kind of get out of hand in the park. Mm-hmm. But the park police, by the way, which are, I don't think that there's any longer any, it used to be one African-American for years. I think he retired a couple of years ago. And so one of the things that we had a discussion in closed session with the Federal Oversight Committee that I'm a part of is that we raised the question, because we're getting a lot of complaints about misconduct by park police who have everything, same color squad cars, same insignia, you know, unless you look real close, who people are misidentifying as MPD when in fact it's the park police.
Well,
the
see,
only
that
thing
was
that really
point, that was the point I was bringing up. I mean, it was a clear delineation at one time.
At one time, years ago. Yeah.
And that's blurred. Yeah, I mean, it seemed like they didn't all even carry weapons then. Maybe
well, they always did, but here was the trick. You have a two-tier, you have sworn, what are called sworn park board police.
Okay.
Who are eligible, who are legally able to carry a weapon, and then you have member park rangers. And a park ranger kind of rides around on the little scooter and et cetera, but cannot carry a weapon.
Oh. And that's
so
still the case now today.
Beg pardon.
That's still the case today, I'm assuming.
It is. The park rangers are not authorized to carry weapons. They can give you citations, if you will, and they can make an arrest upon calling a park policeman.
Okay.
Now, they used to have at least a couple of African Americans. I just think right now, because the complement of the park police, I believe, is 47, and the park rangers are probably about 60, you know what I mean? There used to be at least one African-American as a park ranger, but I'm not sure, given this new regime and what's been happening, I'm not sure that we even have that one.
Well, what about the University of Minnesota? I think for years, one of my neighbors, Mr. Bannum, might have been.
Mr. Bannum was a distinguished and decorated sergeant. Mr. Bannum, as you know, is now deceased.
Yes, a wonderful
Mr. Bannum,
man, wonderful family,
at one
grew up with the whole group.
Yeah, we had two African-Americans going back over 20 years on the University Police Department, and then for a while we had the son of the late Riley Gilchrist, who was one of the most decorated African-American police officers on the Minneapolis Police Department.
Yeah.
I understand that we have one African-American on the University of Minnesota Police Department. But we would have to ask the university to confirm that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, another dismal statistic, you know, for which really kind of points out the rationale and the reasoning for the climate that we kind of live in here in the Twin Cities. You know, and I'm hopeful that, as you are, and I know your program is really dedicated, along with your article and the you know, attending the meetings you attend, dedicated to really trying to you know, keep us relevant in the city. That we're citizens too, we're taxpayers, we live in the city, and we deserve, you know, every right to you know, to be educated, to have, you know, good jobs, to live in a good, safe neighborhood as any other citizen.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of what, you know, I've noticed the cause of you, your program, your articles, and that's why I'm certainly glad to be a part of it. And I wanted to mention one thing, too. I don't know if you had a chance to meet, well, I'm pretty sure you did, a gentleman I used to work with for many years. He was originally from the north side and came to the south side, but he recently passed away, a Mr. Ronald Bell.
Yes,
and
I do.
Bell,
in fact, Ron Bell's brother, who is still living, Ward Bell, and
Ward
I grew
Bell,
up together, and in fact, used to play basketball at Phyllis Wheatley.
And I saw Ward at the Ron service. Ward,
yes,
and Steve,
oh, okay,
and the,
okay,
whole family.
Okay.
I happened to go over there. So, you know, I just wanted to give a shout out to Ron, and he had continued to be a great community advocate. You know, he started what was called an advocate unit with Hennepin County. And what,
yeah,
the advocates were they were individuals, if you had a child protection case or you had a social work case and you had a dispute, well, these advocates would come in and be supportive to you. They'd become kind of a buffer between the county and the family who really didn't know how to navigate the system, which was part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a whole unit to do that for several years and then went into the child protection area, you know, before retiring. So Ron I think he's a great loss to the community. I mean, in recent years, I used to run into him a lot at the Sabathany Community Center.
He was housed there for, at least a decade, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was housed there. I remember when he was positioned out there, maybe 20 years ago, and we used to oftentimes stop by. But I had known him from day one, and, of course, as I said, his brother and I were part of a group of little colored guys, if you will, who grew up at the old Phyllis Wheatley, when Phyllis Wheatley was on 8th and Bryant in North Minneapolis.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, I still have a picture. Gee, that picture is quite aged. We used to have a team called the Trotters, kind of after the name of the Globetrotters.
Okay.
And I look at that picture, and Ward Bell was one of those that was a member of that team.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some of the other gentlemen
have passed from the scene, if you know. But, yeah, Ward Bell was a good basketball player and et cetera. He later played at Minneapolis North, and we were down at Minneapolis Vocational because they didn't let too many Negroes play sports. At North back until Gene Lewis and David Lewis and Irby Chatham and the legendary Robbie Ingram came along in 1958-59.
Wow.
But yes. We're talking about names and legends. Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to have breakfast the other day with a gentleman by the name of T. Williams.
Theatris Williams came here from Mississippi by way of Chicago.
Mississippi, and I, you know, we had a wonderful conversation because he knew my father very well and actually had grown up with one of my father's uncles in Mississippi, which I never knew that. And it was such a good conversation I had with him, how they went to school together. And, you know, in those days, you know, people really didn't have cars. And if you lived 2 or 3 miles from somebody, you'd really never see them.
That's right.
No way to get there, you know, unless you had a horse.
What a small world it is. I well remember the actress when he came to work as the director of boys programs at Phyllis Wheatley.
At Phyllis Wheatley, yeah.
Yeah, man. And then later succeeded the late Harry, Mr. Thomas, who actually left from Phyllis Wheatley and went over and took over at Hallie Q. Brown in St. Paul. Henry Thomas, you remember Henry Thomas walked kind of with a limp, and I remember T. Williams, as we called him, taking over. If we had ever had been successful in getting that historical museum,
we wouldn't
have to be bothered talking about this.
We could refer people to find
the information.
That's right. Phyllis Wheatley was such a great, settlement house in the north side. You know, people just coming into town, and you had a place for recreation, you had a place of safety, you had a place you could find housing, you had all your social services right there, whatever you needed.
Let me just say this
kids.
For our listening audience, in fact, they had 4 lovely apartments on the second floor of Phyllis Wheatley. Those apartments came about as an outgrowth of the policies here in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, which lasted to around 1954. Negroes could not stay at white hotels.
Now, wasn't there a Mr. Kozel? Was it
Breedlove? Yes, Mr. Kozel Breedlove, who was an all-state. First of all, he was a twin. He and his brother were two of the greatest athletes to come out of Minneapolis North in 1938-39. They were One was champion in discus. Kozel was champion in the shot put, and they were a monster, and they were part of a triad, if you will, in which a gentleman by the name of Snooky Patterson was one of the greatest high and low hurdlers at that particular time, 1938-39. That's all out there in the history books. Unfortunately, we don't have any black museum. But Kozel Breedlove later became the athletic director and then boys athletic director, as we like to call him, at Minneapolis North, at Phyllis Wheatley, and served and with distinguished in that position for almost 25 years.
Yes, you know, I happen to see a picture of it in a very great book by the great Walter R. Scott, you know, Minnesota's Black Community, and also the Minneapolis Negro Profile, where he chronicles a lot of, you know, a time in this city when this city was very vibrant.
Yes.
And we had a lot of people that really had a kind of a foothold in this city, to the point where they could not only help themselves and their families, but they could help the ones coming up. And I think
that is absolutely correct. Mr. Scott was one of the great historians. He really put together the periodicals, if you will. I retain a couple of his publications and have used them for years to remind myself personally at age 77 about what it really was. You know, I mean, I get so tired of people coming here and making it appear that there was never a struggle here.
Yeah.
And Mr. Scott left us that are still here with the necessary chronicle that you can go to those books and you can identify, man, because in that book, Brutus Cassius, wow.
Oh.
The head of the clergy and et cetera. We've done on these programs over the last couple of years, Mr. Allen and myself have periodically raised that question, and I know it's caused some people to run and scurry to authenticate, hoping that some way or another we're misrepresenting things. But, yes, Mr. Scott, wow. In fact, wasn't he honored here just a short time ago?
Certainly was. They had a program at the downtown Minneapolis Library, and actually there's another one coming up, I think it's July 19th, at the Hosmer Library in South Minneapolis to chronicle those books, and many things are in the works with the Minnesota Historical Society to really, bring those books back to the forefront and also assist in doing something new for the community.
Yes,
so.
Yes. In fact, it was out of Mr. Scott's book that I was able to remind people that in 1937, as an outgrowth of the economic policies of racism and et cetera, that the Negro Loan and Loan Association Company was founded, 1937.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in that book, and if you really know the south side of Minneapolis, you will recognize that it was right there where the Dreamland used to be, across the
street.
That Dreamland takes
us
back to A.B. Cassius.
38th and 4th Avenue corner there. That's
It
was there. So, well, I do, I guess I had one other. Oh, I wanted to ask you too, Mr. Edwards, about the Minneapolis, the Community Action Agency. I thought I saw something in the news about that recently.
It was placed in receivership. You're talking about the organization that was under the leadership of Mr. William Davis, a longtime Democratic Party activist. They are negotiating plea bargaining as it pertains to he and his son. I felt so bad about his son. His son's law enforcement career was absolutely unraveled, if you will. I understand the scuttlebutt around the U.S. Attorney's Office is that they want Mr. Davis, who you've noticed, you haven't seen a lot written about him, to turn state's evidence and identify the role of those that served on the board of the CAP agency, Community Action Agency,
Ooh.
And who were also the recipients of some pretty nice monies. for almost 20 years.
Wow. Well, now, there's some pretty high-profile people on that board. Now, I have no idea whether they were involved in any type of act.
Well, it's how the law is written and interpreted, because if you've taken on stewardship, irrespective if you assign somebody to come to the meetings to represent you, but you're still there, your name is still there, you still have a fiduciary responsibility to maintain the integrity of the organization. And the U.S. attorney is looking at it, but see, the problem is, unfortunately, there are so many Democrats who have held seats on that board, and the U.S. attorney, of course, is a Democratic appointee, and Washington doesn't want to do that, particularly as we're coming up on the presidential campaign, because, you know, they want to keep Minnesota in the blue column.
Well, what is this, a one-hand wash the other type of a situation? I don't know if I follow.
Well, there are just too many Democrats who could possibly be indicted, particularly based on the fiduciary responsibility and that portion of the law.
Members,
so
on
they're
that.
Trying to do some selective pointing out, selective allegations, if you will, selective indictments, if you will, and then kind of work it that way, if you know what I mean.
I see. But as far as the Community Action Agency itself, as it was operating in Minneapolis,
it's dead.
I'm assuming someone else has taken over those duties.
It's the suburban cap agencies.
You have a phone call.
And how long are we going to be able to go, Mr. Allen? Because we are at 3:30, but we have a phone call. Let the phone call come in. Come right ahead. Hello, caller.
Hello. Yes.
Yes, caller.
Mr. Edwards.
Yes.
This is Brother James. How you doing?
Oh, fine, Brother James. How you doing? And I need to hear a signal from our engineer, Mr. Anderson, because we were slated only to go in an hour, but I know we can make a formal request. So, because I know you have some observations, Brother James. So, go ahead. What's your question? And we'll see if we can hold on. Go ahead.
That good gentleman that you just named, Walter Scott. Now, you remember the last time I saw you in person? You know, me and you were the only two African Americans of color that was in this particular place that we were at, and as the very next week, they had this secret gala at the library honoring that very book that I brought to your attention, and you and I spoke on that in public. Only you and I was there of color. So who heard about our conversation? And then the next following week, they were throwing a celebration at the library.
First of all,
honoring
Mr. Scott. Yeah, that book and that event was put on by the children of Mr. Scott. So We want to be fair about that. There had been discussion for a long time about Mr. Scott. So that activity down there, actually, I have to correct you, James, because the children of Mr. Scott called into this program about 3 weeks, a month, before that situation to announce it. Yeah.
Oh, so you did speak to them prior to me bringing that to your attention about the book.
Oh, James, we had been talking about the book. I've had the book in my library for 30 years.
Yeah, I understand that, but I was just saying that I kind of thought that was kind of strange, because when I brought it to you in public the very next week, it was going on at the library, and I didn't see anything in the public paper or anything, not even in you guys' spokesman recorder.
Well,
yeah, well
I don't control
the spokesman recorder. I'm just
There actually was an article that I saw in the spokesman recorder, and it was posted at all the libraries. And again, as I mentioned earlier, there will be another program at the Hosmer Library on July 19th. And what I understand, the family is going to really try to put out some more information, again, with the spokesman, the community papers, maybe even the Star and Tribune, so that people can know about it and hopefully attend.
Yeah.
Well, these were the kind of books, gentlemen, that the public library was getting rid of, and they got into the Friends of the Library, which is across the hall there. And even your books, Mr. Edwards, they were going for like 50 cents and 25 cents.
Yeah, I know.
I know. Yeah. We talked about that. Yeah. 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 Only Sumner Library has copies of my two books, most recent two books.
Mark?
Because they got rid of the they did have a surplus of copies, and I do understand they still have about 5 or 6 at Sumner Library. Yeah. You're absolutely correct.
I bought those copies. There's a lot of African American good history on the city and the state of Minnesota, African Americans being sold out of the downtown library.
Yeah.
At that bookstore called Friends of the Library.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just indicate to you that something about the books you were talking about. See, I have from 1956 a pristine copy of the centennial edition of the Minneapolis Beacon, featuring the Negroes in Minneapolis, which was a part of and is copyrighted by A. Scott Publications. So I just want to be clear on that. And, wow, you know how far back this goes, gentlemen? A letter of introduction from the then mayor of the city of Minneapolis, Eric G. Hoyer. And let me do this for both of you gentlemen. Mr. Walter R. Scott, editor and publisher, Minneapolis Beacon, 1309 East 23rd Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Wow. M, doesn't that bring back memories to us?
Boy, I tell you, it certainly does. And, I do want to mention, too, I just got word from our production staff that we are able to go an extra 15 minutes.
All right. Brother James, go ahead. Do you have any other observations about some of the stuff we've been talking about?
Yeah, I wanted to go back like last week when Brother M went to connecting the dots on some of these here incidents that's going on, and he felt like there was kind of like different agencies or entities are in cahoots to kind of keep the black community in limbo. Why is that?
I don't know. M, go ahead. Do you remember that conversation?
Well, vaguely, I really don't know. I mean, it seems to be kind of a covert action. I mean, on the one hand, you see that there should be social services. There should be things like, child protective services to help families and to help children. There should be other community agencies. But for some reason, we seem to fall on the side of the punitive part of social services as opposed to the helpful part, which is jobs and education and health and well-being. It seems like, for some reason, our community is perceived as something that's crossed over into the side. Well, we need to have more of a correctional type of a thing in our community as opposed to an uplifting and an educational and a positive type thing, and nurturing the kids, children's programs, school programs for kids, after-school programs, summer jobs. I mean, I can think of growing up here in the city, and I had summer jobs every year when I got out of school.
Mm-hmm.
There were opportunities. It was at a park board, whether you were just sweeping up the park or picking up balls or cleaning up afterward. It was something that would put a little money in your pocket and keep you going. And those are the kind of things that I'm just not seeing enough of. I think that those kind of things can have more of an impact than you would think.
If you can recall, back in the 70s in other major cities, they had government programs called CETA and Step Up and all these other government programs. Now you don't hear any of those programs even in existence in any black communities anymore.
That's correct. Yeah, you're certainly correct. In fact, at one point, that the CETA programs were very viable and politically strong here in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Pillow, in fact, comes to mind as probably one of the most dynamic individuals as it pertains to running those organizations. The late Edgar Pillow, who was a great high school and college athlete, by the way. If I'm not mistaken, left Minneapolis to take a position in, I think it was Cincinnati, Ohio, and he, I know, passed from this life, 6, 7, 8 years ago. Edgar Pillow, yeah.
And in those days, too, organizations like the Urban League, their LEAP program, which was, they were tied into federal funds and things like the CETA, and they were kind of tied together to administer those programs to see that those things got distributed in the black communities. And, you know, I just don't see that real foothold where we have that pipeline where we can access those dollars and make sure that it comes into the community to do good things.
You're absolutely correct, M, that is what has happened. By the way, we have, 15 minutes. We have about 9 minutes left, so you understand, James. And, of course, our phone lines are also open. If we have another call coming in, then we will take that call. Again, what M says as it pertains to the historical, you know, portfolio and et cetera, we used to have that. I can remember a time when the Urban League had 114 employees and almost over $3 million in funds, which would be the equivalent to about $13 or $14 million in today's dollars. People said that the philosophy that was driving the Urban League was antiquated, 1960s-style political activities, wasn't needed anymore. We needed a new vision, a new strategy, and et cetera. So now we have an Urban League. I think it has, I don't know, 9 staff people, I think.
Well,
according to the Nation of Islam, the Urban League hasn't been doing anything but being a spy entity against the black community since the 50s.
Okay.
Well, I take exception to that as a person who headed the Urban League as chairman of the board. I don't know that we did anything that talked in terms of spying on our people. In fact, we saw ourselves as being handled just the opposite of that we were considered to be significant troublemakers. It very well could have been. You know, I do hear the head of the Urban League now finally fessing up that they're receiving really nothing. The NAACP nationally is not receiving anything. But I would have to take grave exception with the Urban League here under leadership from the period of basically 1969 through 1989, over 20 years. In fact, in 1969, it would be pretty hard to have been spying because the Urban League had a total staff of 3.
Well, the spying took place, I believe, back in the 50s, 59, if I can be correct.
Yeah, could have been at some of the facilities, yeah, depending
okay,
on.
Now, are you familiar, Mr. Edwards, are you familiar with the professor out of the University of Wisconsin, a Beloit named Professor Washington? He wrote a book, and he stated that the Urban League is an agency and an entity that honors their friends and punishes their enemies, and I'm done.
I can believe that. I can certainly believe that, yeah. And I'll just say this to you, James, as you go. I certainly learned that lesson as the head of the Urban League when we took on General Mills. And M will tell that story one of these days of what happened. But, of course, it opened a lot of doors at 3M for a whole lot of black folk to get work. So, again, I can't speak.
Is there a lot of money missing right now from the Urban League in North Minneapolis?
There's nothing happening with the Urban League, James, involving the Urban League in North or South Minneapolis.
Isn't there some monies that's supposed to be missing? Somebody run off with some monies?
Oh, they're talking about the gentleman that is now in Atlanta. And Mr. Allen first reported that and raised that question. You would be talking about Scott Gray.
Not our friend Mr. Scott Gray from Madison, Wisconsin. He's been known in Wisconsin as the Urban League closer.
Yeah, I know. When he came over from Milwaukee to take the job in Madison, yeah.
there was a TPT special. You can go on demand and look at it. There was a TPT special about the Urban League out of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, and those people spoke very disparagingly of him, and they stated that he helped close them up in Madison, Wisconsin, but yet they got back up and running, and those younger guys over there were getting decent jobs back into the construction field.
Yes, we saw that. In fact, on this program a couple years ago, we talked about that as just after Mr. Was hired to be the next Urban League president because they had changed the title. It has changed from executive director.
And if you can recall, Mr. Edwards, it was Mr. Allen that said, how come he don't run some kind of little class inside the Urban League there and teach the kids how to open up Subway franchises, which he's got a few of them himself.
In Madison, Wisconsin, yeah. The gentleman we're talking about, Scott Gray, did have at least two franchises in Madison, Wisconsin, as we understood it. But all of that was talked about when he was being reviewed by the then Urban League board and being hired for the position. But again, community was comfortable with who it was that was selected. In fact, the woman that he defeated was the daughter of one of the most significant radical and political academicians at the University of Minnesota, who died here a couple of years ago from cancer. This was her daughter, and I remember many thought that the daughter was going to be become the heir apparent, and all of a sudden this gentleman came up here from Madison, Wisconsin. But he had been here before, but I don't want to even get into that. He had actually lived here back in the 1980s and had a problem with some drug convictions. Oops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Brother James. Thanks for calling. We got about 4 or 5 minutes left. Mr. Anderson, do we have any additional people holding? If so, give us a signal.
No, you do not.
Okay. I think those were a series of interesting questions, M.
Yeah.
But you know, it's always good to have historians.
I think it is, to know where we've been and what we can do so that we don't continue to make the same mistakes. And I think that's why, history is so important, to kind of say that all of these things, these missteps that have been made, let's not keep doing them.
Absolutely.
Let's try to move ahead. And, I did want to ask you before we sign off here. I know we're getting towards the end, but...
I'm keeping a clock on our clock here. We've got about four minutes on the dot. Go ahead.
This Orlando situation is just a very serious situation, and I guess I wanted to get your impression specifically on the, response that we've heard from the presumed Republican presidential candidate, Mr. Donald Trump. And
let me just say this, an excellent question. In my column next week in the Spokesman Recorder, and I know that tonight, I put it out there to drive a discussion, because I'm hearing others now saying it. I raised the question in my column that the incidents in Orlando could very well be the recovery piece that Donald Trump needs to possibly win the presidency of the United States. Because he is appealing to the darkest, if you will, or the worst of the American electorate. And he's on the attack. I listened to him closely this afternoon in a speech before OOPS, the National Rifle Association, and he was laying it out there.
Very dangerous. There was a movie that a friend of mine told me to watch a year or so ago. It's called The Siege. Okay. And so I couldn't find the movie. I went to the library. Usually I can get any movie at the library, an older movie. This movie was like in 1999 or 2000.
Okay.
Library didn't have it. Couldn't find it. I found a used one on Amazon.
Good place. Right. Somebody always got one.
What it is it's the scenario that's being played out. There's a presidential candidate that preys on the fears of the terrorist things happen, and this is how he rises up. It is a chilling movie to watch because it was like 16 years ago.
Yes. And, I think that I now remember specifically the movie you're talking about, because as they were moving towards the conclusion, whoever the good persons were in the movie had discovered that, like a lot of the terrorist acts and bombings and et cetera, were actually being carried out by the government.
Exactly. That's what it was. Bruce Willis and Denzel Washington, and it was big actors, but the movie just never really, I had never heard of it until he told me about it.
Yes. In fact, Bruce Willis was the general who had helped
put together
the conspiracy. And Denzel Washington was an FBI special agent. In fact, at one point in the movie, the entire office building housing, the FBI was blown up. Remember that? And Denzel Washington lost many of his colleagues and friends, and it reached a point, this is where I think, you know, the movie piece, where he actually arrested Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis, yeah.
If you will. We're man, we've gone over time. Look forward to have you back as a co-host next week.
Right.
All right, take care, my brother.